protect the glass containers of milk piled beneath. Genevieve catches sight of him too, and immediately leaves her post. A few moments later, she opens the front door with a wide smile and a wave. The milkman steps out of the truck in his usual all-white uniform. And Christ, can his clothing be any tighter? He grabs a basket from the side of the truck, returning her wave. I step forward, recognizing him the moment I get a better look at the face beneath his white cap. Ernie, I think his name is. He's one of very few young men that were exempted from the draft for having a job deemed essential. He delivers to Angelo's estate, and too often I've heard Angelo's sister, Lillian, gushing over him. She's completely taken with him, and it's a wonder Angelo hasn't shot the kid dead just to end his suffering from hearing her yap about him. And now he's approaching my woman, who's home alone. It's no goddamn secret that lonely wives tend to invite milkmen into their homes for a bit of fun. And now that I recall, Lillian has mentioned that this knucklehead in particular has accepted a few of those invitations. She had complained about it because he's evidently too scared to accept her invitation, being the sister to a mob boss. Without thinking, I slide my gun from my trousers as he steps up onto Genevieve's porch. My chest burns with jealousy, hating that he has all her attention. If she dared to invite him, it'd be an incredibly cockeyed decision. Ernie would be dead before he could take a single step, and then Genevieve would have a terrible mess to clean up afterward. She's a charming woman, yet I notice the tension lining Ernie's shoulders and his wooden movements. He glances around nervously as he grabs two empty bottles from the insulated box on her porch, exchanging them for fresh milk from his metal basket. When he straightens, she's handing him the payment, her mouth moving as she says something to him. My eyes narrow as I count each second their skin touches. But he moves away quickly, taking several apprehensive steps away from her as if he can sense my wrath. Oddly, he doesn't seem to respond to her. He flits his restless stare around the house instead. He's incredibly nervous. And the more I study him, as Genevieve continues to attempt a conversation, the more I realize he's jittery and eager to leave. Ernie abruptly turns and scurries off the porch right in the middle of Genevieve's talking. It's incredibly insulting, but I'm too relieved that he's leaving to find a need to correct that behavior. He's in his truck and whipping it around within seconds, the glass milk bottles rattling as he zips out of the driveway, leaving gravel dust in his wake. Genevieve stands at the doorway, wearing a perplexed expression. Huh. Guess the milkman doesn't like Parsons Manor.
April 11th, 1944. I wrote a letter to Daisy today. I told her the truth about John and his gambling, expressed how utterly heartbroken I am over my husband's actions. I didn't hold back with her, and a large part of me dreads her response, partly because I know what it will be. It's the same thing she has said many times throughout the years we've been friends. You settled for him. I also told her that I miss when we were young girls, always up to no good and the best of friends. Back then, our biggest stress was homework and quizzes. And while Daisy didn't have the best home life, like me, we were able to escape our realities with each other. Daisy is still my best friend, and though she lives a few hours away now, I tell her everything. Except about my phantom. It's the first time I've kept a secret from her, and I feel awful about it. Not only because I feel like I'm lying to her for the first time, but rather, if this man ends up hurting me, I will have made it easy for him to get away with it. I'm such a fool. Chapter 5, The Raven. April 12th, 1944. The red lipstick glides across my lips with ease, though my hand quivers, causing me to smudge it above my Cupid's bow. "You fool," I whisper beneath my breath, hurrying to grab a tissue and wipe the mistake from my skin. Once more, my trembling hand bears little grace, and I wipe too much away. Frustrated, I slap my hands on the counter, leaning heavily on them as I pinch my eyes shut and try to just breathe, for God's sake. "What are you doing, Gigi?" My phantom has been visiting again. Just yesterday, he was standing outside the window, watching me, as he seems content to do. John left for work, his breath still reeking of booze as he walked out the front door, and Sarah has gone to school. Though the man has appeared in my window only a few times now, he comes during the day, hidden in the tree line where shadows conceal his face. Today feels different, like something more than his lurking beyond my window will happen. And for reasons I refuse to consider, I've done my makeup heavier today and am wearing my best day dress. For the better part of the morning, I avoid my own thoughts, at least the ones that are screaming at me, asking me what on earth I'm doing. I have no answer. Hours tick by while I go through my routine of chores, washing our clothes before hanging them up on the clothesline behind the manor, dusting dishes, picking up messes, and prepping for dinner. All the while, there isn't a single sight of him. Later, I sit on my rocking chair, staring out the freshly cleaned window, waiting for my shadow to materialize. Yet, he doesn't, and my disappointment grows with each passing minute. Sighing, I finally give up and relent to my flustered conscience, berating myself for being so silly, waiting for a strange man to show up outside my window, as if his actions haven't been concerning, as if my actions aren't concerning. Trudging over to the kitchen island, I slump onto the bar stool where bank notices litter the countertop. Rather than agonizing over my phantom, I stupidly focus on the papers that show my husband's betrayals. I'm angry with myself, John, and the entire world. My mood is foul when I hear the slight creak of the front door, but my brain instantly accepts it as my daughter coming home from school. I don't even bother to look at the clock to confirm, and instead call out, "Afternoon, sweet pea. How was school?" There's no answer, and that's when awareness comes barreling back to me, my eyes snapping to the clock above the stove. It's only 11 in the morning. Sarah wouldn't be home yet, nor would John. My muscles tighten as quiet footsteps approach me from behind, the sound slow, heavy, and deliberate. My breath catches as my spine snaps straight, but I'm too frightened to turn around. Is it him? My phantom? The pitiful muscle in my chest ceases to work, and I can no longer draw oxygen into my lungs. Terror encases my being in solid ice. Has he come to hurt me, to make John pay with my life? Who will find me? Please, God, don't let it be Sarah. A form appears in my periphery, my stare immediately focusing on him as he silently makes his way around the island. His scent envelops me first. It's intoxicating, and my frazzled brain takes a moment to process the notes. Sandalwood, oranges, and a hint of tobacco. Just as suddenly, he's before me, every feature in plain sight. He's breathtaking, and so very tall, donning all black attire with his fedora, long trench coat, button-up shirt, trousers, and dress shoes. It should be a drab outfit, but he looks expensive thanks to the glinting gold ring adorning his pinky finger. Even smells expensive. The man stares down at me with piercing, pale blue eyes nestled beneath thick, dark brows, a contrast to his olive skin. though something is off with the left one. Instead of a black pupil, it's completely blue, giving his eye an almost translucent effect. He's blind in that eye, and my curiosity piques as to how it happened. Regardless, it seems to only heighten his beauty. His black lashes are long, giving the illusion that he has coal lining his eyelids. The alluring man studies me carefully, just as I study him. Never in my 34 years has a man made my breath stutter. But this man, he commands the very lungs beneath my bones. My gaze traces over his nose, a small crook in it from a prior break, down to his full lips that are framed by a 5 o'clock shadow, though the small grazing of hairs doesn't dare hide the sharpness of his jawline. He doesn't speak, nor do I. I'm frozen completely solid, and I fear only his burning stare has the capability to melt the ice from my bones. I exhale, the breath stuttering from my throat. Chest heaving, I still don't move a muscle as he slowly circles around the island. Within moments, he's next to me. Heat radiates from his body in waves, warming my skin, yet goosebumps rise on my flesh, and I can't help but shiver. "What's your name?" I ask breathlessly. He doesn't speak. Instead, he lifts his hand and gently brushes a crooked finger against my cheek. I gasp, my skin coming alive beneath his electric touch. It takes monumental effort to keep still. He circles around me, dragging his finger along my skin, moving it down to the back of my neck, and sending chills down my spine. I glance at him, now standing on the other side of me, and note the breathtaking smirk tilting his lips. Then he moves away, his touch disappearing, and his footsteps begin to retreat. I gather enough courage to tip my head over my shoulder, staring at his back with my mouth agape. Almost as suddenly as he appeared, he's walking out the front door and leaving me in utter silence. "What just happened?" I whisper to myself. My fingers brush across my cheek, where he had set me on fire just moments ago. There's no physical evidence he was ever here. Yet I feel his presence so strongly, he may as well have left his soul behind. And my God, I fear how badly I hope he stays. April 12th, 1944. My red painted lips press against the paper in my journal just as John, with his mussed hair and red eyes, stumbles through the bedroom door. The first few buttons of his white shirt are undone, and his tie is sloppily pulled away from his neck. He's hammered. Again.
"I'm telling you, Gigi, Hitler ain't gonna win this war. I just know it."
He slurs, tugging at his tie until the cloth breaks free. He trips over his toes and catches himself on the nightstand, causing a few items to topple to the ground. "My God, John, how much have you had to drink?" I whisper shout, setting my journal on my nightstand. He waves his hand dismissively.
Not much, just a few drinks with Frank at the bar,"
he answers, though half the words are unintelligible. "Not much?" I echo in disbelief. "You're going to break something." He sits heavily on the bed, and that causes me to jump out from under the quilt and storm around to his side. I grab his arm and tug. "You're getting your filthy clothes all over the sheets. I just cleaned these," I reprimand, my frustration mounting as he pulls away from my grip to take off his work shoes, only to fail miserably, nearly toppling face first toward the floor. I catch him in time and once more try to pull him off the bed, which proves difficult when he's hardly capable of bearing his own weight.
"Gigi, I'm fine,"
he mumbles, finally standing upright. "You know better than to sit on the bed in your outside clothes. especially when you've just come from a bar. I don't know why I'm focusing so much on something so insignificant, rather than the fact that we don't have money for him to spend on booze. He's come home like this more nights than not, and every time, I find out he's gambled and lost more of our money that we don't have. Again. Tears well in my eyes as I drag him to the washroom. I keep my eyes downcast as I lean him against the sink counter and begin unbuttoning the rest of his shirt.
"Why you got your red lipstick on this late?"
he mumbles, his thumb swiping over my lip and smudging the color down my chin. I huff and jerk my face away from his touch. "I just finished writing in my journal. I got to it later than usual today. I've been cleaning the house for the better part," I snip, though my words shake from my mounting anger.
"Look at me, sweetheart,"
he coos, pinching my chin between his thumb and forefinger and forcing my gaze up to his. I stare at him, searching for the man I fell in love with, for the man who swept me off my feet, vowed to my parents that he'd always take care of me, and who loved me so much he built this house for me. But the person in front of me now, I don't recognize him anymore. He's more of a stranger than the man outside my window. Disappointed, I remove my chin from his grasp and slip his button up down his broad shoulders. Only then do I notice the bruises marring his chest. "Dear God, John, what happened?" I ask, brushing my fingertips over the purple and blue mottling his pale skin. He turns, forcing me to stumble away as he unbuckles his belt. His back isn't much better off, and dread sinks down my throat and drips to the pit of my stomach.
"Just a few people at the bar that run their mouths too much,"
he mutters. "John, please tell me this isn't from the people you've gambled."
"Drop it, Genevieve,"
he snaps, turning his head just enough to allow me to see his side profile. Anger furrows his brow, and his stare is sharper now, less glazed. I shake my head, the tears returning tenfold. A few spill over to my cheeks, and I quickly brush them away as my husband finishes undressing. Before he can see me break down, I turn away and rush back to the bedroom. My heart has climbed into my throat, constricting in the tight space and making it feel as if it takes effort just to beat. By the time he makes it to bed, I've cleaned the red off my lips and slipped beneath the covers, my back facing him. Without a word, I switch off the bedside lamp, leaving us in darkness.
"I love you, Gigi."
I don't respond. He's breaking my heart, and the only thing I can feel for him is resentment. I close my eyes and picture a different face to fall asleep to, one that doesn't belong to my husband. April 12th, 1944. He came back again. I dare say I would be disappointed if he didn't. John left for work and Serafina went off to school. The minute the house emptied, I waited by the window. Not my proudest moment, I must admit. This time, he walked into the manor. I froze when he did, terrified of what he would do, but also anticipating his next move. When he revealed the entirety of his face to me, without shadows concealing his features, my breath caught. He's beautiful. Piercing blue eyes, a strong jawline, and big. So very big. He approached me, still refusing to speak. He caressed my face so gently. He circled around me, letting his fingers drift across my skin. I shivered beneath his touch, and he smiled. His smile made my heart stop in my chest. And then he left, walked out without a word. I almost pleaded for him to come back, but I stopped myself. He'll be back.
Chapter 6. The Phantom. April 28th, 1944. If there's one thing I've learned about Genevieve Parsons, it's that she's as devoted to writing in her journal as she is to her husband. I have no plans to come between her and her penmanship, but the latter, that I would love nothing more than to change. Rain descends from the heavens steadily, blurring my view of her through the bay window. Yet I know every detail of her face, features I've grown intimate with over the weeks. The softness that she reserves for her daughter, every crease around her mouth and eyes when her husband comes home drunk, the fire that ignites in her bright blue eyes, or the way her soft lips part when she catches sight of me. If it were up to Angelo, she would be collateral for her husband's debts, a means to an end. Yet I fear she's meant to end me. John managed to pay off his debt to Tommy, but then just last week he dug himself into another hole. Now he owes Tommy a grand and hasn't been able to claw his way out of it yet. So yesterday, Pauly showed up at John's business, reminding him of his debt to the Salvatores, which John promised to pay. He asked for up to 3 months, which Angelo has granted him. If he knows what's good for him, he will pay Tommy back sooner. I slide my hands into the deep pockets of my trench coat and slowly approach the front door. My hat shields me from the worst of the storm, droplets pouring from the rim and pattering off the leather of my shoes. If Genevieve is my end, then I open the door to death with no hesitation. The warmth from the fireplace is instant as I enter the foyer. Above me, the chandelier's crystals twinkle in the soft light emitting from the sconces hanging on the dark walls. Cold rain puddles on the checkered floors, leaving a trail behind me as I head toward the living room to my left. As soon as I round the corner, I'm faced with Genevieve standing before her chair, the piece of furniture rocking behind her. Chest heaving, she stares at me wildly, as if she's an untamed animal that can't decide if it wants to devour me or run away. I can't imagine that I stare at her any differently.
If you wanted to hurt me, you would have by now.
She breathes, almost as a placation to her own fearful thoughts. She's wrong. I do want to hurt her. I'd love nothing more than to see her bare ass reddened by my hand, or the faintest of bruises around her neck where my fingers grip as I drive into her, and those beautiful eyes filled with tears pleading for me not to go any deeper down her throat. Husbands don't hurt their wives the way I want to hurt her. They save those darker desires for their salacious nights in brothels, where those actions are considered disrespectful but acceptable. Men are supposed to be gentle with the women they love, take care of their fragile bodies, and treat them like fine china. I'm confident John has already loved her in such a way, and here she is, so very unsatisfied. If she weren't, she'd never stare at me so seductively. There's nothing gentle about the way I plan to love Genevieve Parsons. With slow, deliberate steps, I approach her. Her breath quickens as I near, yet she doesn't move, doesn't run from me. My hand twitches, desperate to touch her. Even when I'm a mere foot away, she stays.
Why won't you speak to me?
She asks, her voice a soft whine. Because she's not ready. She's not ready to hear what I plan to do with her, to her. Most of all, she's not ready to hear that I won't be letting her go. Not ever. The thought of it has my hand twitching again, this time for the gun tucked in the back of my trousers, ready to unleash my wrath on anyone who stands in my way of keeping Genevieve. Just like every other time I visited her, I lift one finger to her soft, reddened cheek. It's the only contact I allow myself, a small reprieve to my yearning, yet not nearly enough to abate it. I want so much more, but her daughter will be home from school soon. I retreat and quickly leave, back out the front door, before I do something stupid like stay. April 30th, 1944.
The FBI pinched Manny Baldelli's son, Gabriel,
Marco Viscuso announces, leaning back in his chair and locking his fingers across his stomach. He's the don of the Viscuso family, and beside him is his underboss and son, Gianni, and their capo, Luca. The Viscusos have a good standing relationship with the Salvatores, having operated beneath Angelo's command for decades. As the godfather of Seattle, all families are beholden to him. The Viscusos are loan sharks and are ruthless in ensuring they're the only other family in Seattle that has the authority to lend money, besides the Salvatores, of course. But Angelo has always been more interested in the trafficking business. Marco stares at Angelo and his underboss and brother Alfonso with clear expectation. What are you going to do to handle this? Alfonso gives him nothing in return. He's always been a reserved man, and despite his quiet nature and limited conversational skills, he's intelligent and astute. He's a year younger than Angelo, but you'd think they were twins, both with jet black hair, aside from grays invading up through their sideburns. Aquiline noses, tan skin, and dark, bottomless eyes. The two of them grew up with birds dripping from their arms, and it's no surprise they married beautiful women.
I heard about Gabriel,
Alfonso responds shortly. Marco stares at him for a beat, waiting for him to expand. When Alfonso stays silent, puffing on a cigar, Marco turns his gaze to Angelo. You a rat? I ask calmly, wishing I had my own cigar with me right about now. There's a buzzing beneath my skin, and I haven't been able to place the cause. It's a nagging feeling, like there's something you've forgotten, and you can't recall what. We've gathered at a restaurant, Casertas, on the outskirts of the city. It's a remote location that resides in neutral territory. Many mob families come here to dine, and there are strict rules in place that no one is to fight. The owner, Orazio Caserta, is the son of a congressman and offers his restaurant as a haven for all families, regardless of their loyalties or positions of power. Their family has had ties to the mafia, even in Italy, and it's a relationship they continue to maintain. They only ask for two things: mutual respect and peace when in their territory. It's a rule that even Angelo wouldn't dare cross. We are all very aware that Orazio holds an extraordinary position, and if any of us were to break his rules, his father would have us in cuffs and in solitary confinement in a matter of days. No trial, no hope of freedom, only a promise to slowly rot away in the dark for the rest of our miserable lives. But that's not what truly keeps us all in line. Orazio has made examples out of many and has built quite a barbaric reputation, one that mob bosses tell their young children stories about at night. My fingers drum against the cherrywood table in a rhythmic pattern, and my knee bounces as I cast my gaze over the restaurant for the millionth time. Orazio designed Casertas to transport us back to Sicily. Stucco cream walls, vaulted ceilings with raw beams, rounded stone doorways, dark woods, paintings of grapes hung on the walls, and plant life mingles throughout the booths and tables. Fedora Mingarelli croons Un'ora sola ti vorrei in the background, and the volume of chatter is at a quiet murmur. There are a few other families dining today, but no one that is cause for concern at the moment. Upon entering, the doorman frisked us to ensure we brought no weapons onto the premises. Another strict rule to access the restaurant. It's calm, peaceful, yet it still feels like something is off.
"Ain't all Baldelli's rats?"
Marco retorts, scoffing.
"Last time a Baldelli got pinched, he was singing like a canary."
Luca pipes in, lighting a cigarette, inhaling deeply, and peering at me through the smoke billowing over his face.
"We have reason to believe that Gabriel could cause trouble for us should he run his mouth,"
Marco continues, his finger beginning to tap restlessly against his hand.
"My son, Alessandro, was quite taken with one of Manny's daughters. He swears he didn't reveal any information about our operations to her or her brother, but my son is young and uses his cock more than his brain. Before Gabriel was pinched, he was heard talking to others about private matters with my family, matters he would have known nothing about had my son kept his mouth shut."
Angelo arches a brow and takes a large swig of his Macallan scotch, hissing at the burn and smacking his lips. Still, he says nothing.
"We've pledged our loyalty to you, Angelo. I was there for every one of your son's birthdays. I was there when Antonio—"
"I'm aware of your attendance throughout my son's lives, Marco," Angelo cuts in, an edge to his tone. Antonio is Angelo's firstborn son, and he's currently fighting in the war alongside his brother and the second oldest, Alessio. The younger two, Aquino and Aretino, are 17 and 16 respectively, and are on the brink of being drafted should this war continue for years yet. That his two eldest sons are fighting in a brutal war has been a sore spot for Angelo since the day they were deployed 2.5 years ago, and the knowledge that he may have to see off two more has driven him to the bottle on many occasions. Angelo is many things, but no one could ever claim he isn't a damn good father.
"Speak plainly, Marco,"
Angelo clips impatiently.
"I'm requesting your blessing to put a contract out on Gabriel before he can rat to the fuzz,"
the Don says.
"I understand this decision may come back to you, so I want it on the record."
I study Marco closely, noticing how his stare shifts toward the doorway every so often, as if he's waiting for someone to appear. I turn to look, noting that the entire wall is glass. I return my focus to Marco just as he's glancing away from me. His left eye twitches as I stare at him. I may only have one working eye, but I'm not blind to the stench of apprehension leaking from Marco's pores and his obvious nervous tic. Angelo taps his pointer finger against his glass contemplatively, takes a slow sip, sets it on the table, then taps again.
"Gabriel is Manny's son. Should he be whacked, that could put my own sons in more danger,"
Angelo states.
"I understand."
"I don't think you do, Marco,"
Angelo drawls, leaning back in his chair and staring down the Don.
"Clearly, you didn't raise your son to understand the implications of not only sleeping with the daughter of a rival family, but sharing business operations. Which leads me to believe that Alessandro does not see you as an authority figure to respect. That makes me question your authority too, Marco."
Marco's lips thin into a firm line, and he casts another quick glance toward the door. Again, I follow his line of sight and find nothing.
I assure you, Angelo, I have drilled into Alessandro's head the consequences.
If you want to drill consequences into his head, do so with a bullet, I cut in calmly. Marco chokes, staring at me with bewilderment. Luca and Gianni glance at each other, apprehension beginning to line their shoulders. Gianni is Alessandro's older brother, and by the rage flashing across his eyes, he doesn't appreciate my suggestion. As Angelo's consigliere, I'm in a unique position to counsel him. He also entrusts me to step in, offering suggestions or solutions on his behalf. And while this particular suggestion is cruel, it's not one that will be expected to be acted upon, which is exactly why I've said it.
Your son has become a problem. If he suffers the consequences, I will allow you to ice Gabriel,
Angelo says, reading my mind as he always does. It's an ultimatum Marco won't take. Angelo gave him an impossible decision rather than an outright refusal as a lesson. You can't have an out-of-control son and then cover his mistakes by putting other families at risk. If Marco wants to fix his problem, remove the actual problem. If Gabriel's clipped, Manny will retaliate against Angelo and come after his sons. This risk costs far more than trouble for Marco's business operations.
I understand, Angelo,
Marco says finally, bowing his head. Angelo waves his hand, signaling the Viscusos to leave, an order they waste no time in heeding. Angelo and Alfonso are silent long after the Viscusos are gone, yet that feeling persists. Angelo, I say, staring out the window, watching as cars pass by on the street.
Hmm?
The McKellen is pricey. Knocking it out of Angelo's hand would be a great offense, but expensive scotch will never be worth more than his life. I slap his hand, sending the scotch careening off the table. Before Angelo has time to process what I've done, I'm out of my chair. Down, I shout, watching in slow motion as a black car stops outside of Caserta's and the barrel of a Tommy gun appears from the passenger window. I'm tackling Angelo to the ground a second later, just as dozens of bullets crash through the glass windows. Chaos erupts, and within seconds, everyone frequenting the restaurant is on their stomachs and crawling to find cover. I roll Angelo beneath the table, lying on top of him to shield him from the spray of bullets as an enforcer unleashes a magazine into the building. Dinnerware shatters, thousands of glass shards raining over us. Food and drinks splatter to the tiled floor while cutlery, pictures, and lampshades come crashing down. It feels as if it lasts hours, but could only have been a minute or two before the magazines emptied. Then, a squeal of tires and a deafening silence, save for Tango del Mare by Oscar Carboni singing from the speakers. Heart pounding, I peer down to find Angelo on his back, staring up at me with a feral grin on his face. Holding my gaze, he croons along with Oscar, though a wild look glimmers in his eyes. Sighing, I roll off him and onto my back, quickly checking to ensure Alfonso is alive. He catches my stare, rage simmering in his dark eyes, but otherwise appears unharmed. Angelo's voice draws my attention back to him, and I watch my friend sing, his voice growing in volume, even as patrons begin to check each other for injuries, while a few women softly cry in the back corner. I chuckle when he directs his gaze to me, his hands animated as he bellows the words. Then I join in, the two of us belting out the lyrics while the restaurant falls silent once more. Some of the patrons are merely spooked, and some of them are dead.
Chapter 7. The Raven. May 2nd, 1944.
Mama, is Daddy okay?
Sarah's sweet voice draws my attention away from the faucet and the hot water cascading over my hands as I scrub at a dish that's been clean for the last 5 minutes. Is he okay? Am I? Our poor daughter has known nothing but stability for her entire life. Seeing her parents slowly crumble must be confusing to her. We're failing her. John is slowly descending deeper into the pits of his addiction to alcohol. His addiction to gambling has already taken hold of him, and now the draw of poker chips is no less alluring than a beautiful woman's crooked finger. All the while, Sarah lives blissfully on, convinced that she comes home to a happy family every day, or at least she used to. She used to not have a worry in the world. It breaks my heart knowing that may no longer be the case. Yes, baby, of course he is. I lie, finally setting the dish on the towel beside the sink. My hands are bright pink, and there's a lingering sting as I shut off the water and unplug the stopper, an obnoxious sound arising as the dirty water drains.
He smells like whiskey when he comes home now.
I close my eyes, so very disappointed that she knows that. I know. He's been indulging a bit lately, hasn't he? I say, staring at the sudsy water slowly swirling down the drain, feeling like it's a perfect representation of my life. Since when did it become comparable to dirty water filtering out of a sink?
I hope he doesn't for my birthday party,
she mutters. I frown, feeling utterly helpless. Her 14th birthday is this Friday, but we're having a party Saturday. During the day, a few of her girlfriends and other classmates will meet at an arcade for cake and a few games. With the sugar rations, we won't be able to provide many sweets, but all the moms are hoping to scrounge up enough to satisfy the little heathens. Later that night, we'll celebrate, just the three of us. And I don't know that John will leave the booze alone. He'll have hell to pay if he doesn't. But lately, my wrath isn't enough to stop him. I would hope not disappointing his daughter would be convincing enough, but I can't be certain about that anymore either. Sweetheart, I will do everything in my power to make sure your daddy behaves, I assure. I hate making false promises, so I don't dare swear to her that he will, but I'll certainly protect her however I can.
Do you think it's because he doesn't love me anymore?
The moment the last word leaves her mouth, my heart instantly cracks into pieces. Oh, baby, of course not, I assure, turning to face her. She's sitting on a stool at the kitchen island, drawing random doodles in her notebook. I rush over to her and pull her into my embrace while placing a kiss on top of her head. Your daddy loves you so much, as do I. Never think otherwise. She nods, the movement shaky. She doesn't cry, but I can feel from the slight tremble rattling her bones that she's emotional. I can't imagine how long she's been thinking her father's drinking is her fault, and that only forms more fissures in my fragile heart. She doesn't deserve to feel like that, ever. How about when Daddy comes home, I talk to him, and we plan a date night for the three of us? Maybe a drive-in, or we could go out for ice cream, I suggest, already feeling a pinch of worry. We still have no money, and the last thing I should suggest is to spend more. But I'll scrounge up every last penny if it puts a smile on her sweet face. I'll figure it out. I always do.
I'd love that, she whispers.
I pepper a few more kisses over the top of her head and release her. She's at that age where my hugs have time limits now. Before I return to the sink, I catch sight of a few of her drawings. My heart drops when I notice she drew a figure of a man wearing a long trench coat and a fedora.
Honey, who is that man you drew?
I ask lightly, pointing at the sketch. I quickly cross my arms, tucking my trembling hands beneath my armpits. She shrugs.
I don't know, children and their cryptic, unhelpful answers when you need them most. Have you seen him before? She shrugs again. There's been a couple times I thought I saw him outside our window, but when I looked again, he wasn't there. Whatever is left of my heart is now scattered into a million different pieces, none of them where they belong. I clear my throat. You tell me if you see him again, yeah? I guess, but he's not real, Mama, she insists, rolling her eyes. Oh, how I wish that were true. May 3rd, 1944. Parsons Manor is haunted. Has been since the moment I moved in. Those poor souls that lost their lives here are angry. They always have been. Some days, I worry that I'll end up here with them. Because despite how vengeful the spirits are, I love this house. So much so, I feel it's become a part of me. When I'm angry, the temperature in the house drops as cold as the ice that clings to my words. You were supposed to help with his problem. Frank stands beside me while I rock in my chair, staring out the bay window, my gaze locked onto his reflection in the glass. Or rather, what's behind him. There's someone standing behind him. Something. It appears to be around 7 feet tall, and while its form is entirely black, its sharp claws and red eyes are clear. Whoever he was when he was alive is no longer who he is now. It's no longer human. Nor does it want Frank in this house. The sight should bother me, but I've long grown used to the phantoms in this manner. Must be why I'm so reckless with the one who continues to materialize before me, long enough to whisper his finger across my flesh before disappearing again. I look away from the sinister being and refocus on Frank's reflection. I don't bother to tell him he's not alone. Frank sighs.
Gigi, I've been trying. You know how stubborn he can be.
I do know that. I also know that we've barely scraped by these last couple of months. John recouped some of what he lost, just enough to pay a few bills. But we're still on the brink of losing everything, Frank. And his drinking. Frank takes a menacing step toward me, though his ire is reserved for his best friend.
Has he hurt you?
I scoff. Don't be ridiculous. However, the nervous energy spilling from my pores is potent enough to taste. My fingers flutter over my white and blue floral dress, twisting the thin cotton material until wrinkles form. I spent an hour ironing clothes this morning, including this dress. I force myself to stop abusing the fabric and settle for staring out the window again. The monster is no longer in the reflection, and I let out a sigh of relief at that. Sometimes they like to scratch and push, and I'd hate to explain to Frank that an invisible entity is responsible. It may make John's drinking habit appear reasonable.
Gigi,
he says with a sigh.
I told you. If you need help, I'm here for you. Whatever you need, anything at all, just tell me. Even if it's comfort, I can help with that too.
I shake my head, speechless and uncomfortable. John may as well have stuck his fist down my throat to grab hold of my heart and crush it. I can't speak around it. Can't stop him from shattering the muscle that I always thought was his to take care of. I'm just so tired. Tears well in my eyes, distorting Frank's reflection until my vision is as blurry as a window during a thunderstorm. All the turbulent emotions inside me rise until they're bubbling out, and before I know it, the dam releases. He came home so drunk last night, he didn't even recognize me. I choke out past a sob. I sense Frank's charging toward me, so I hold up a hand, stopping him in his tracks. The last thing I need is comfort, at least not from him. He had spit up on his shirt, and when I was unbuttoning it to help him remove it, he laughed and asked me to promise not to tell his wife. A tear spills down my cheek, and I quickly wipe it away. I shake my head, unable to finish. Unable to tell his best friend that he pinned me to the bed and fucked me, fully convinced I was a random floozy. When he was finished, I slapped him sober. I've never been the type of woman to let a man treat me so awfully, and I certainly won't start for my husband. He had no idea what he had done when he awoke this morning, not until I told him, at least. He apologized profusely, claiming that his actions were not his own and that he deserved to be slapped for it. Like he had every day for the last 16 years, he tried to place a soft goodbye kiss on my lips. But for the first time, I turned my cheek to him. Wherever my forgiveness is, it's not with him. Anyway, I continue, sniffling and wiping away a few more stray tears. I don't expect you to fix his mistakes. I just want my husband back. I want my daughter's father back. If you can make that happen, that's the only thing I want from you. The temperature in the room seems to drop, and for a moment, I'm convinced the monster has returned. I face Frank, only to find him glaring at the floor, his knuckles bleached white from how tightly he curls his fingers into his palms. After a few beats, he turns his fiery stare up to mine. Frowning, I open my mouth, prepared to ask him what's wrong, but he bites out his response first.
As you wish, Gigi.
Then he's turning and storming away, the front door slamming shut behind him moments later. I startle, a hand drifting over my racing heart. What has gotten into all these men? I can't keep up any longer, and I'm beginning to favor the ghosts that haunt these halls. At least they are predictable. May 3rd, 1944. I don't know if I've ever been so hurt. My mother has called me many names in my life, spit many insults at me, degraded me in ways that have stuck with me for decades. None of that compares to what John did to me last night. In our years together, our lovemaking has always been gentle, soft, the two of us hidden under the covers, nearly silent, as to not wake our daughter down the hall. Last night he ravaged me, and it hurt. Had he been in his right mind, had he even known who I was, I might have loved it. The aggressiveness, the untamed wildness to it, and the loud grunts coming from his throat that I don't think I have ever heard before. Except he didn't know who I was. He didn't take care of me and ensure I was ready for him. He didn't care about my well-being. He didn't care that in his mind, I was another woman. It hurt. It still hurts. Chapter 8, The Raven. May 16th, 1944.
What has gotten into you, Gigi?
John asks me, clearly affronted by the way he glowers at me while tugging at his tie, loosening the black and red striped fabric. He stares at me as if I'm a stranger. He just finished his supper and is undressing before our armoire. Usually, I eat alongside him and Sarah, but I excused myself, claiming that I didn't feel well, and left my husband and daughter alone at the dinner table. Something I've only done when I was truly ill, too weak to put on my red lipstick. I crawled into bed in my nightgown and cracked open my leather-bound book of Edgar Allan Poe poems. However, the evidence that I'm not as unwell as I'd like him to believe is smeared across my lips now. I stare at the pages, the words to The Raven blurring in my unfocused vision. I'd always been hopelessly called to horror and mystery novels as a young girl, obsessing over Edgar, Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, and many others. They are the reason I became enraptured with the Gothic style, My mother hated that I read them, but she finally gave in when I became a much more agreeable child with one of their books in my hand. But even Edgar can't save me from my husband tonight.
Is it because I forgot your birthday yesterday? I told you I'm sorry about that, and we'll celebrate soon.
Unlike yesterday, he didn't come home drunk tonight, so his perception is sharper than it has been lately. He must see the secrets I'm storing inside beginning to leak through my pores. No, it's nothing, I deny, giving him an incredulous stare. Though it did hurt that I turned 35, and he didn't say a word once he finally came home. Sarah took the day off school yesterday, and we spent the day together dancing to the radio, baking cookies, playing board games, and then camping out in the glass room. John didn't come home until nearly 10 at night and was completely sauced when he did. While our daughter and I celebrated my birthday, he stayed out drinking and gambling all night. And frankly, I was okay with that. I'd take his absence over his inebriated presence any day. The only birthday that mattered to me was Sarah's anyway. Thankfully, that day flew by without a hitch. John was a little sauced, but he did nothing to embarrass Sarah or me, so I refrained from lecturing him about it. I just feel a little under the weather today. Lies. I never used to lie to my husband, to anyone for that matter. My mother would have whipped me silly had I ever dared tell a lie to her. Telling the truth has been ingrained in me since I was a child. And now look at me. This morning, he woke me up with an apology and a peck on the forehead. Fresh carnations awaited on the kitchen island, along with a new dress. Then he was off to work again while Sarah left for school. He promised he'd come home on time, which he did. But his playing poker and getting drunk on my birthday wasn't the only reason I felt unsettled today. No, earlier, the strange man entered my home again. I've lost count of how many times he's visited now. Many days, he stays outside, watching me from afar. Other days, he likes to see me up close. Admittedly, I've long since grown desperate to know his name, so I begged him to tell me, even offered to get on my knees if he'd only whisper it in my ear. And when that didn't work, I offered him a kiss, even a touch of my breasts or between my legs. He smiled, yet my scandalous offerings were to no avail. He brushed his fingers along my cheek, tucking a black curl behind my ear and leaving me a shivering mess in the wake of his electric touch. The things I was willing to do just to hear his name. Guilt eats at me, tearing apart my weary soul. The shame I feel is so heavy, and there are many moments where I gaze at my husband and ask myself how I could ever even think to stray. It's been 2 months now, and still I keep my visitor a secret from my husband. Why? I'm not sure I'll ever know. I love my husband. I've loved him for years. Except I don't know if I'm in love with him anymore, or if I ever was. John continues to stare at me, suspicion inked into his irises.
Is there anything you want to talk about?
The truth is on the tip of my tongue, teasing the air between us. But then he grabs a whiskey bottle left stranded on the dresser from a previous night, unscrews the cap, and takes a long swig while he waits for my answer. The truth dies, and I swallow it back down, the words burning a path down my throat as if I had been the one to drink the whiskey. No, there's nothing to say, I whisper. Who he is now,